Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past. Lauren Chater is the author of three historical novels, The Lace Weaver, Oliver's Wife, and The Winter Dress. The fourth novel, The Beauties, was released in 2024. The work has a particular focus on women's stories that I'm looking forward to talking about. It's a great pleasure to welcome her to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you here today. I usually start by asking people, when did they first start thinking about a career in writing?
I think for me, I was always a writer when I was a child. I wasn't good at anything else. I wasn't good at sport. And growing up in the Shire in Sydney, you know, it was kind of expected that you were good at sport. But I was very bookish and imaginative and kind of airy-fairy. So that was what I stuck with. And my parents said I had to do an activity. And so I chose to do creative writing one afternoon a week at this creative writing club for nerds, basically. And I was always reading as well. I always had my nose in a book, always thinking of stories and ideas. And so for me, writing was more of a, you know, just something I did. I didn't really think about it being a career until my son was born, until I had some maternity leave up my sleeve. I worked in sort of corporate communications for a while, did a whole bunch of different things, and then figured out that maybe I should give writing a proper go. I didn't expect to really be published. I wrote a whole bunch of different things, not historical fiction, and they were all pretty bad. So that was kind of my apprenticeship into writing. And then after I finished my manuscript, I sent it to Simon & Schuster, and they picked it up, which was so good.
That club you were involved in, was that involved through your school, or was it like a community-based thing?
Yeah, so it was after school. It was a creative writing group for kids that were interested in
writing. But through your school?
So it wasn't through my school, it was through a different school. But yeah, it was run by a lady who was just interested in creative writing, and it was just really nice to have that group.
Wow.
And yeah, I know. I often think that I should actually, you know, do it myself, run one myself, but I'm just so busy, I don't have time.
Are there groups like that running now, though? Do you know of?
I think there must be. I don't know. I would love to send my daughter to one if there was one sort of around, but
it's interesting. Like, I remember going to a theatre group that was on Saturday mornings in this huge old house in Battery Point in Hobart. That it's Sesheron House. It's a historic house, and
right,
we used to all show up on Saturday morning and do theatre type things, which was really amazing to have that validated, that you could actually kind of just do this stuff, because rather than just doing it on your own at home kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, it is really special. And I don't think you appreciate those things until you get older, do you?
Yeah.
That people gave you those opportunities to do that. So, yeah.
And you you won the inaugural HNSA First Pages Pitch Contest at the very first HNSA conference, which was way, way back in 2015.
Right.
I'm just wondering, how did that help you, or did that help you? And, you know, even with just confidence and kind of connections and things.
It was actually amazing. I'd never won anything for my writing before that. And as I said, I'd been writing some really bad work up until that point. But that was the manuscript that I really felt very passionate about, strongly about, and that I could actually, felt like I could actually finish it. So to have that, my writing validated, and to feel sort of credible, like I was a real writer, was an extraordinary experience, and I never expected to win. It was the first, it was the inaugural competition, as you say. So us who entered it really had any idea what was going to happen, but it was such a special moment, and it was great for connections as well. I think, I don't know if my agent now, Tara Wynn, if she was on the panel, maybe she was on the panel the next with for the next one. But yeah, I mean, just even getting and being able to get an agent, putting it on your, you know, on your cover letter, on your pitch letter, was so important to me.
Yeah. So you've kind of hinted at this, but in something of a bit of a Kate Bush Wuthering Heights tale, you were kind of signed to Shimon and Schuster for four novels. How did that all come about?
So I had met my publisher, Roberta Ivers, at think it was sort of a literary speed dating kind of event. And she said, send the story. But I actually hadn't finished the manuscript because I was procrastinating. And, you know, as you do with your first proper manuscript, going over it again and again, trying to fix up the first part of it and not finishing it. And she said, send it. And it was 6 months of me putting her off every couple of weeks. Oh, I'll send it soon. And then I realized that I'd missed one of her emails, and I hadn't replied to her and said, I'll send it soon. And I thought, no, this is it. She's never going to ask me again. So I gave myself a deadline of about 2 weeks, and then just sent it off to her. And she got back to me 2 days later and called me into the office and offered me that amazing deal. So that was like, it was a dream come true, really. I was very lucky. Yeah, I didn't even have an agent at that point, so I was unagented. And some people would at that point have gone and gotten an agent, but I felt very comfortable with Roberta. I liked her style and still love talking to her. She's moved on to a different publisher now, but I still call her, still have lunch, talk about books and ask her for advice. So having that relationship with your publisher is so important, I think.
Did you have the plans for novels in place at that point, or were they the ones that you were signed for in the future just completely blank?
I pitched the second novel, I think, and we may have spoken about the third novel. The fourth one, I didn't have any idea what I was going to do at that point. But yeah, I had a little pitch prepared because I had a feeling that they would ask me when I went in about other books. You know, they always say that that publishers want you to have a career. You know, they want to take on someone who's going to write more than one book. So that is always the advice that I give to writing students when I'm teaching, is to always have another pitch ready to go.
So with what was the first kind of idea you had for this new novel, The Beauties?
So I was reading the online website Atlas Obscura, and I saw an article about these 17th century portraits, the creation of these portraits called the Windsor Beauties. And the writer of the article described them as like the 17th century version of Maxim's Hot 100, which is kind of gross, but also says a lot, I suppose, about, you know, beauty as currency in that time, women having to use their looks to get what they wanted, and how that all worked, because there were a lot less opportunities, of course, for women to move up in social circles and to find success and be happy and creative and things like that. So I was really interested in the idea of these women who were the models and the muses for this creation and of these portrait series, but also the idea that these women who were all the king's mistresses and, you know, the courtiers, they were all competing for attention, and that they were never in the same room together ever in life, and now they're all hanging in Hampton Court Palace and you can go see them and they're staring at each other for eternity. So I just thought that was kind of funny.
I know how these women feel. I've always been like Tess d'Urberville, a victim of my own provocative beauty. But
well, me too. I'll be all.
have you actually seen the paintings?
Yeah, so I went to Hampton Court a few years ago, actually the year before COVID. So
lucky.
So lucky, yeah, because I would have found it really hard to sort of write about. And they're it's amazing, actually, when you walk in there. It's kind of in a quieter area of Hampton Court. Hampton Court was where Henry VIII lived and Anne Boleyn, where she was executed, you know. So it's all, it's a haunted place. When you go in there, you feel, and I mean, it's literally haunted because they've got actors dressed up as Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn who walk around and they're completely in character. So you can ask them for a selfie or something, but they'll be in character. But the paintings in the gallery seemed to me particularly kind of haunting and special, and looking out overlook the courtyard.
So how many of them are there?
So there are 11 portraits, and one of them may be lost or missing, which forms part of the story.
So I guess the novel is about these women kind of trying to establish some liberty and some kind of move away from men, but are trapped in the patriarchy. Yeah. Were they kind of fine lines you were walking to kind of give these women some agency, but not too much agency, and to keep that in, in context?
Yeah, it's always tricky with those when you're writing about the past, isn't it? Because you don't want to write the wrong thing, but you also want to read about women who are brave and interesting and creative, and those women have all, you know, we've always existed. We've always existed. But there's an element of resistance, isn't there? So it's about finding that, I suppose, that resistance in whatever form it takes, even if that's painting sets, as Amelia does. But there were also extraordinary kind of things that I discovered about that time period. I was reading an article in The Guardian about a playhouse called The Fortune, which was it was burnt down. It was in London. It was burnt down at the beginning of the 16th century. But then these women investors brought it back to life, and they pumped all this money into it, including that one of them was a carpenter. And so I thought it was really extraordinary that that these women had kind of taken back their roles. These roles. Playing themselves, because the 17th century was the first time that women were allowed to act as well on stage. Charles II loved women, as we know, he was the merry monarch, and he decided he wanted to see them prancing around on stage, showing off their ankles and things like that. His amusement. So he, wrote an edict that said that women could act in plays for the first time. Before that, it was considered, illegal.
There's stories going around which may be apocryphal, but the term drag came from a note in a Shakespeare play to be dressed resembling a girl, because there could not be female actors, so
yes,
they had to notate where that was. The novel has three narrators. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about how you chose those particular ones to tell the story.
The novel has, three narrators. The first is Amelia Lennox. She is a beautiful woman who has come to court to London to beg the king to restore her husband's fortunes, which they lost in a sort of, terrible way. Her father-in-law made a mistake, and they've lost their fortunes. And the second narrator is Henry Greenhill. He is an artist, the assistant to Peter Lely, who paints the portrait series. But he's offended his master, and he's lost his favour, and he needs to get it back. So that's sort of his motivation, and he wants to be part of the painting of the series, because it's kind of a way to get back in his master's good graces. And then we have the third narrator, who is Anne Hyde, who is a real person, and she is a young woman who is flees the English Civil War with her family. She ends up in the Netherlands, exiled with a whole bunch of other English courtiers, where she catches the eye of the Duke, who is the Duke of York, who is the King's brother. Although at this time the king is the king of nothing, you know, he doesn't have any power or lands. He hasn't been restored to his throne yet. But Anne falls in love with the Duke, and then eventually she endures a lot of scandal and commissions this portrait series. So the lives of these three narrators kind of blend together as the novel goes on, and you figure out why those three stories are running together.
Okay, did you have actually other characters that you thought about using their point of view, but you didn't? You ended up not using them?
I had originally, when I first started writing, I wrote from the point of view of the portraits themselves. And so it was a kind of a weird, more like a magic realism kind of story. But it didn't really work. It didn't work because, you know, Anne Hyde telling her story through a sort of medium of, or a sort of ghost story, and then having to tell the story in the past, it was just too confusing. So it didn't work, but it did give me an entry point into the story. And I guess what it taught me is that, you know, there's really no shortcuts. You have to just go where the story takes you. And then sometimes you have to make those really hard decisions. What do they say? Like, kill your darlings. You have to kill your darlings in order to make the story better, because something's not working. So that was a really good lesson for me as a writer, even four books in, still learning.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's wasted, really.
No, exactly.
So Amelia Lennox's section is in third person past tense. Henry Greenhill's is in third person present tense. And Anne Hyde is in first person past tense. I'm just kind of wondering how you arrived at that mix of things and what you were endeavouring to do with that.
Yeah, I usually just go with whatever feels right for that story, for that particular timeline. Anne's sections had to be set in the past because she is she's quite unwell by the time we catch up to Amelia and Henry's timeline. She was she died of breast cancer at 36, so she was really young. And I wanted those sections to feel like she was kind of explaining or giving her account of why she had chosen to commission those portraits. So it was, a bit more of a sort of a retrospective look back. Amelia's sections too, I think in third person past, did we say? Feel a bit more like a narrator kind of telling the story of this beautiful woman, but then there's sort of a reverse, a twist. So I wanted that kind of traditional, more traditional, I suppose, narrative style. And Henry's is in first because Henry is a man, and for him, life is all about being in the present. And I actually found it very liberating to write from a male perspective, because I just felt like for him in that time period, you know, he had everything. So you just stick yourself in that position and you just go for it. I thought it was really interesting. But of course there are always nuances and, you know, and he has his own sort of challenges to overcome. Very freeing to write, I think, from a different gender.
Yeah. I think too, though, using those different points of view and tenses, you know, delineated the different narrators very clearly as well.
Cool. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad it worked. Yeah.
So you've kind of given us a bit of insight into your research, but I'm just kind of wondering, you know, more how much you do and how you get down into the day to day. I think, like, one thing from the Lace Weaver for me was when you were talking about the Russians' obsession with watches, which really. I helped a man write his autobiography. He was Hungarian, and he talked about when the Russian forces invaded Hungary, how they were obsessed with watches. So I thought you'd done an amazing you know, job there to get down to that level of detail.
I don't even remember that, Greg. I don't even remember that.
That's the one thing I used to have is a good memory. But how much and how do you get down to that day-to-day, you know, kind of detail, which is where it really comes alive?
Yeah, true. I think it's harder, isn't it, the further back we go because we have less first-hand records. And that watch thing that you were talking about, I would have, I'm sure, read that in someone's memoirs or something when I was researching. There was another thing from the lace sweeper that people always remember, the milk.
The discs of milk.
So when I was writing that book, obviously I read a lot of, a lot of people's biographies, and I interviewed people and they could tell me about what it was like to grow up in that time. Harder though with the 16th and 17th century, even though when you think about it, we have a lot more information. We don't have those first-hand accounts. But there were a couple of things that I was able to get a hold of. Anne Hyde's diary. She wrote this little diary when she was 12, actually. And it's actually only a few pages. But it's all about, we fled to exile. I don't know if we'll ever see home. I miss my Aunt Babs terribly. This is a little diary. I probably will never write in again after this week. But she sounded like a 12-year-old. She sounded like my daughter, you know. So it's just finding those little...
Did you find that? Where's that preserved?
It's online because a lot of, obviously, those diaries are digitized now. It's called Project Gutenberg. And a bit like JSTOR or something like that, Trove, they digitize all those accounts. So that was really helpful. I used a lot of paintings to get a sense of what it would have been like, although there's, of course, a level of artifice with painting, which is really what the book is about, because it's, a facsimile of what life was really like. But there are still little details in there, I think, and that are interesting. And also, of course, a lot of historical kind of records. But that stuff can get so dry. So I think it's good if you can go in with a focus of what you're kind of looking for.
Yeah.
In this case, it was painting. So for me, an art.
Yeah. I always used to try and find, like you're saying, you know, even self-published biographies or autobiographies and things like this, which, you know, sometimes the stories were not that great, but they would often just contain, you know, observations or just comments or just even, you know, the day-to-day stuff of, you know, how you cook dinner, how this stuff was done. So
That book, Svetlana Alexandrovich book, The Uncommonly Face of War, Woman's War. She did like millions of interviews, thousands of interviews, but she did, everything's reduced down to one or two lines. And it's just those one or two lines sometimes, isn't it, that you need, which illuminates something about that. Yeah.
So how much, and you might not feel this, but how much do you feel like you waste, you know, like how much research is actually wasted? If you can call it waste.
Yeah. I don't know. It's so hard to say, isn't it? Because if you didn't know what you didn't know, maybe the stuff that went in wouldn't be as good. Hard to say. I think at some point, you do just have to get stuck in and start working. I think if you can focalize things through a character, then maybe you can narrow it down a bit to what that character needs to know. You don't need to know everything, because that character only needs to know those certain things at that certain time.
Yeah, I do feel like all that other stuff, though, does just flavour up the whole thing, you know. So it's not ever wasted, but it does feel like that sometimes when you've spent months searching something out. So how much did you know about painting before you started all of this? And how did you research that part of the story?
Yeah, that was really fun to research, obviously. I know a little bit about painting. I am have always enjoyed art, but I'm not a professional and I wouldn't even call myself, you know, a visual artist. So I had to do quite a bit of reading art history texts, but that was actually so fascinating. I found a couple of really amazing books about Stuart portraiture. And the evolution of portraits from sort of this way of preserving or showing wealth, you know, to this kind of idea of propaganda, the portrait being, you know, for, especially for royalty and things like that, was really important.
Yeah.
I also read this really fascinating book when I was researching the last book, The Winter Dress. Was about, it was called The Late King's Goods. I don't know if you've read it, but it's about Charles the First, so Charles II's father, the one that died in the Civil War. And when he was murdered, they sold off all his artwork because he had amassed an amazing collection, but no one was allowed to see it, which was also part of the problem with, you know, the divisions between royalty and the common people. But they had this big fire sale, and they sold it off for like a pound, whatever it was at the time, a dollar, you know, for a Titian or something like that. So all these people, like bakers, you know, knight soilmen, they would like take all these masterpieces home. And it was kind of like this way of saying, well, this is like, I have as much right to this artwork as everybody else. And when Charles was the second was restored to the throne, they had to undertake this big job of getting all those portraits back.
So
they had
a big
scheme. So I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the way that art works as currency, but also says so much about the people, you know.
I mean, you've only got to walk into the Vatican to kind of really understand what art does to people. You know, I remember walking into that building and looking up and thinking, there's another sky above me, you know, and then thinking that's precisely what I was meant to feel at this point.
Exactly. It was a way, wasn't it, of because people couldn't read as well.
Like, yeah,
was,
yeah, that's
you know,
true.
They were illiterate. So paintings were a very easy way of saying, like, this is what you think, this is God.
But also just establishing those power.
Exactly.
You know, the establishment of power.
Yeah.
So a quote from you, for a few hours she must find herself, sorry, for a few hours she must find inside herself a space generous enough to accommodate the demands of her consciousness. She must transform fear into courage. Is this you when you write?
Of course. Of course. It's all of us, isn't it? So, yeah, as you noted, a lot of the Henry sections about art are actually about writing, because that's something that I understand, and being a creative in this world of cost of living crisis, you know, it's so hard. It's so hard to maintain that and drown out all that other noise and just focus on creating. But it's the best thing ever, isn't it? It's salvation. It's comfort. It's purpose. Don't know what I'd do if I wasn't writing. So
tell us about your first draft.
Oh, because I'm in this deadline, like quite tight deadline publishing schedule, I don't have as much time to work on sort of drafts and stuff. So I usually will send my first draft to my editor. I'll probably fix it up as I go along a little bit. But essentially it's 100,000 words. So it's 6 months for writing full time.
But what's that like to do for you? Is that an easy process, or is it a really, really hard process to kind of, you know, that first draft where you've just got the blank page in front of you and you're trying to kind of thresh it out?
I love it. I actually love it. I think it's really fun to do, but it is hard. It's harder than editing. I mean, yeah, it is harder than editing because you've got to create it from scratch, right? And sometimes you worry that you're going off on the taking a wrong turn, and then you're going to have to backtrack. I plan a bit. So as I was going, I was constantly revising my synopsis. And so just to try to keep track of what was going on. And I would also sometimes give myself a word count, but not always, because it's quite hard to write thousands of words a day, as you know. But by the end, I think I knew the ending about a month out, and that was the most exciting thing when I figured out what the ending would be.
Because
it's like a magic trick that you've pulled off again. You never really know whether it's going to work, do you? You're going to have to live with the anxiety of just like going, oh, shit, here I am again. I don't know. I just turned up and we'll see what happens. There is a part of me that just thinks this isn't going to work.
Right. So you don't actually have that much of a plan before you start?
Not really. I have, No, not really. I have ideas in my head that I know, scenes that I know are going to happen. But sometimes it is just nice to let the characters get together and see what.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice to have that organic kind of play happening. But I used to always try to have, you know, like a start, a middle, and an end kind of pretty clear of where I was heading to.
Do you do that now?
I used to, it was the way. It just makes me feel comfortable. It was one of the things I liked about historical fiction was that you kind of had this ladder of fixed events.
A scaffold.
You know? Yeah, and you had to move in and out of that. So I mean, we've kind of hinted at this, but, you know, often when you're doing this stuff, you end up with these huge surprises. So I'm just wondering if you have those and if there were any in this novel that just kind of appeared out of nowhere for you.
It was probably when I started writing Anne Hyde's sort of story, these bits got cut, was writing from her point of view, and she was dead. She was actually a ghost and she was kind of haunting the gallery. But I couldn't make it work. It was just too complicated and too kind of wacky and weird. But it was lovely to actually read about her life, and because she's kind of an unknown figure in royal history. She just married, you know, she just happened to marry the king's brother and then she passed away. But she was also... she was extraordinary because she was the queen, the mother of queens, you know, Queen Anne, that we know from The Favourite, because that sort of made it very popular. You know, that was her mum, and she never knew, because she died so young.
So young.
She knew that her daughters grew up to be queens and stuff like that. So I kind of felt very attached to her, and her voice was the first one that I heard. So it was lovely to get to know her, I suppose, and to learn about her life. And she also endured this kind of crazy, which is in the story, sort of scandal, where all these men came out of the woodwork after it was discovered that she was engaged to the king's brother, to say that they'd slept with her. And, you know, and it was ridiculous, the stuff that they said. She was basically put on trial. It was the trial of gossip and scandal. And I thought that was really amazing that she kind of endured that. And when I was researching that, I found out that the word gossip, the origins of the word gossip were actually, was actually a good thing. Gossip was something that women shared. It was information shared between each other, and they were called gossips. You know, they were the women that knew everything about what was going on. And that information was vital to staying alive at that time. But then, you know, at some point it was decided that these women must be, you know, talking about us, and they must be saying terrible things. and so it became like this negative thing. But gossip was actually something that women used, a kind of network to keep each other alive. So I loved that.
Social media
for the 17th century woman.
So when you're redrafting, how much are you kind of thinking about your reader when you're reworking it?
I try to read in my head. Like, obviously, we all have that narrative voice in our heads as we're redrafting, writing. It's really not until the sort of second or third pass that I will start thinking about how is this, you know, going to sound for the reader. Because there's no point. You're going to change so much structurally from the first to the third draft, for example. But I do think about whether the reader is, it's more about the information, isn't it? It's about drip feeding the information and making sure that the pacing isn't too fast, too slow. Is the structure working? The structure is how the reader absorbs that information, is how they're going to get all that information. So it's more about thinking about those things, I think. And then the last part is the icing on the cake is putting those nice, beautiful, like making the sentences flow.
And
making it a pleasure.
It's really hard, isn't it, when you've worked on something so closely to actually kind of get any kind of idea of what it would be like to read it for the first time.
Exactly.
I guess that's a gift, and if you can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is maybe an odd question, but do you think about male readers at all when you're writing?
I don't think about male or female readers, really, actually. I don't really, yeah, I don't know. That it's not a weird question. It's an interesting question. I just think about people. I just think about the characters, really, is what I think about, and how they're coming across and whether they're, you know, it can be consistent, because I think anything like any inconsistency will throw the reader.
Yeah.
As we know. So, yeah, I don't really think about that. But it was, as I said, really fun to write a male character. I kind of loved it. I think I have to do it every time because it's just too fun.
Yeah. So the novel's set in the 17th century. How did you go about finding the voices of the characters? Because, you know, it's not like those characters were not existing with what we would call modern English. But, you know, you have to make a text that's readable by a modern reader. So how did you kind of strike that balance?
Yeah, I try to write in a way that is maybe a little more formalized, but not too mannered, not so mannered that it throws the reader, I suppose, because modern day readers are pretty, you know, the attention span for all of us, not just young readers, is so short now. You know, we find it so hard to even read a whole book. I don't know about you, but I do now. You know, we're so used to our phones just being there all the time. So it's just about, I guess, holding that attention span, and making sure that it's going to be like an interesting journey. The voice, as I said, Anne's was the first voice that I really heard talking in my ear. And finding the diary from her was really helpful. I also was reading at the time, and I don't know if you ever read this, that Rose Tremaine book, Music and Silence.
No, I haven't read that. I've read some Rose Tremaine.
You'll love it. It's so good. And so I kind of had that 90s feeling in my head of all the polyphonic voices as well. So it was a little bit probably influenced by that I was reading that at the time. Such a cool book. It's about a musician, a lutenist. He plays for the King of Denmark in the 17th century. So it's actually set in the same time period, but it's in Copenhagen or something. So yeah, so I had kind of had that in my head as well in terms of like a narrative voice, that kind of 90s like overarching narrator voice. Mm. Yeah,
was it. So that kind of leads to another question of just how much do you kind of feel one of your projects cross-pollinates the next project, and how does that all fit together?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because having written a couple of books, you do notice that things kind of creep in. There is a cross-pollination. So particularly with this one, because Anne was in The Hague, she grows up in The Hague, and my last book, The Winter Dress, was set also in the Netherlands. So I knew a little bit already about the 17th century court at that time in Holland. So there was maybe a little less research to do in that area, which was great. Because you feel like you can't write unless you have some kind of authority, unless you feel like you have some command of what was going on at the time historically, who was in charge, you know, how the court was operating, and what people ate, or, you know, the sort of social norms of the time. So that was great, but I don't think that's going to happen with the next book. It's set in Scotland in the 16th century. So completely different time period. But as you would know, every book that you write, you learn so much. You just learn so much about the world, and, you know, it informs everything that you write afterwards, in a way. If we all were experts at history, like how amazing would our books be? We knew thousands of years of history, and that was our superpower, to be able to absorb like all that information. You know, our books would be extraordinarily kind of timeless, and we could just retire.
I think as you go on though, you get more adept at, like, it's not a kind of oogie boogie thing where, you know, you find the bits that you need in the world. But I just think once you start work on something and you've got used to doing projects, your antennas are up immediately.
Definitely agree.
And you just, see the most bizarre things kind of happen. Like I remember one night when I was writing Sweet Bitter Cane, which was about the Italian cane workers up on the cane fields. I couldn't sleep, and I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and turned the television on, and there was a documentary about cane cutters in the, you know, in far north Queensland. So,
funny.
You know, would I have watched that? Would I have seen that? I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I'm for the next one researching prophecy at the moment, a sort of like the history of that, and you know, with the Greek in the temples and stuff. And I was reading about this prophecy
in Scotland.
Well, no. Well, there's some crossover because they're the Macbeth witches, you know.
Oh, okay.
They're like the fates. So there's a little bit of a timeless thing going on there.
Right.
They're witches. But it was about this type of prophecy where you hear rustling leaves and like you can hear the gods speak through these rustling leaves. And I was at the front trying to get Pascal, my cat, inside, and it was dark. I was like, Pascal, where are you? He's very naughty sometimes and he doesn't come in at night. And then I heard these rustling leaves and it just made me, and I had this epiphany about the story. And it's just those little things, isn't it, that you, you're attuned to it, you're ready for it, and then the ideas come, but you have ready.
Yeah, I think that's a skill that comes with repetition. Really,
I think
so you've kind of told us what you're working on now, but like your four novels have all been historical fiction. It sounds like the next one will be as well. Do you think you'll go beyond that at some point?
Well, actually, the next one is a bit wacky and weird. I don't know what's exactly going to happen, but I'm kind of writing a contemporary storyline as well as a 16th century, well as a sort of witchy crossover. So I'll have to see what happens with that. I like having those historical kind of markers, because, you know, they inform all history. Yeah, like they inform our contemporary situations. And I'm sure you do too. I think a lot of contemporary novelists actually do use history in a way that maybe we don't promote it as historical novelists, but they, you know, it is that scaffolding that you want to rely on. And it helps you feel when you're writing, like, as you say, that you're not so alone with the work.
Mm.
So I'm not sure, actually. It's just whatever the story demands is what I will do.
And just to finish up today, what's your favorite biscuit recipe?
My favorite biscuit recipe. It's really hard to say. I don't know, but I saw a really good one the other day for a Kingston, like homemade Kingston cream. Mm-hmm. You know those ones?
Yeah.
So good. And I was like, oh, I've forgotten how good those biscuits are. They're delicious. Not like the lemon crisp yucky.
I don't think manufactured biscuits are anything, a patch on what they used to be.
No, but a homemade version though.
Yeah. And that's a very, very good thing. Well, thank you for your time today. It's been great fun. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.